Welcome to the podcast. My name is Isuf, and today we have special guest today, Mr. Maurice Carney, right?
Yes.
And today we have Miss Rinto with us. How you doing?
Good.
Your organization is called Friends of Congo.
Yes.
Could you talk to us about it a little bit?
Yes. Friends of the Congo is a solidarity organization. Really comes in the tradition of organizations like Friends of Ethiopia that was established in the 30s, late 30s, by C.L.R. James when Ethiopia was under attack by the Italians. C.L.R. James and a number of other Pan-Africanists gathered to establish an institution that would defend Ethiopia, educate people about the onslaught that's unfolding on the country. So in the same spirit and same historic tradition, Friends of the Congo established to raise global consciousness about what's transpiring in the Democratic Republic of the Congo, and also on the one hand, and then provide support to local institutions that are involved in social justice struggle inside of the country. So it's a twofold mandate. On the outside, raise consciousness through forums, events, commentaries, interviews like we're doing now, briefings to members of Congress here in the U.S. or members of Parliament in Canada or in the U.K. Engage a broad cross-section of individuals and institutions, labor, faith groups, peace groups. Just tonight I'm here in New York to speak to a coalition of peace groups that are concerned about U.S. militarization around the world. Every conceivable avenue or niche that we can get to let people know what's transpiring in the Congo, in the heart of the African continent, we do that. So that comes under the banner of raising global consciousness. And then we provide support to local institutions inside of the country, which comes in really three forms. We call it the IMF. The traditional IMF that you think about is a different. We're flipping the script on IMF, right?
Okay.
So I is for intellectual. We provide intellectual support. That means connect young people with our Congolese in the diaspora, intellectuals. They have political education courses. So through Skype, we tap them into different intellectual resources from outside of the country. So that covers the I. The M is material. They're organizing on the ground. They need phones, they need laptops, they need cameras. So whatever materials that we can gather and send to them to help them and assist them in their organizing efforts. As you can tell, you need mics, right?
Yes.
And cameras and the lights.
Yes.
So they need the same thing on the ground.
That's
We have access to some of those things.
That's true.
So we send it to them, and that assists them in their organizing efforts on the ground. And then the F is for financial. We'll provide them with financial support. We do some, do fundraising. And through the fundraising, we're able to send them monies. They can pay for minutes. They can pay for modems. They can pay for transportation. Just whatever it is that can assist them in their organizing effort. So that's in a broad overview how Friends of the Congo functions.
That's an impressive job you're doing. Like we were going through the list of all the amazing things that you you're doing, and you know the path that you know like you took, and even the jobs that you did, and you know you worked with the Reverend Jesse Jackson. And that's you know that's another level of like you know because it's not just Africa, like it's so the cause is like larger than
right.
You know?
It's a global African family, you know. So, at least me personally, having grown up in the Caribbean, was born in Jamaica. So, people often ask me, So you're Jamaican. You're working on the Congo, right?
Yeah.
So, but that question usually comes from folks who are not intimately familiar with the history of Pan-Africanism.
Yeah.
Right? Because you can ask for Noam. Mm-hmm. You know, why were you in Algeria? Yeah. You know, fighting against the French, yeah. Right? He was from Martinique.
Wow.
You know, you can ask C.L.R. James himself. Mm-hmm. He was in Ghana.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there are a number of figures. Yeah. You know, Kwame Ture wound up in Guinea, mm-hmm. from Trinidad. Walter Rodney from Guyana. You know, not only was he in Guyana, but he was in Jamaica and mm-hmm. taught in Tanzania, right? His probably most famous work is on Africa, how Europe underdeveloped Africa.
Mm-hmm.
George Padmore,
yeah.
Right? George Padmore is another Trinidadian.
Mm-hmm.
He was a central figure in the 1945 Pan-African
mm-hmm.
Congress in Manchester,
mm-hmm.
and then played a seminal role with Kwame Nkrumah. He was
mm-hmm.
The main point person on the 1958 All-African People's Conference. So there's a rich tradition,
mm-hmm.
Not only from the Caribbean, but from Africans abroad engaging with Africans at home,
yeah.
In order to advance and elevate the condition of people of African ancestry. So mm-hmm. it's that tradition that I see myself personally coming in. So working in the Congo is with Congolese
mm-hmm.
in particular, but not solely and strictly, is really nothing new.
Mm-hmm.
And in the Pan-African tradition,
mm-hmm.
Is not something that's unusual.
Mm-hmm.
It's actually quite common.
Yeah. But are you able to, like, go to Congo and link up with?
Yes, I'm able to go, at least until recently. It's been kind of tough
uh-huh.
of late.
Mm-hmm.
Able to go and link up.
Mm-hmm.
I really would like to spend more time with the youth on the ground.
Uh-huh.
But what I do is not left up to me alone.
Uh-huh.
You know, I'm at service
mm-hmm.
for the movement. And if at this time they believe that it's best for me to be outside mobilizing
mm-hmm.
support
mm-hmm.
and leveraging all the resources that
mm-hmm.
the empire has to offer,
mm-hmm.
even though we're catching hell in the empire, you know, black folks, people
mm-hmm.
of African ancestry still have some access. And so if we're able to leverage the access, the resources and the networks that we have in the empire, and bring that to bear upon the movements on the ground, then that's the role that, that I'll play, you know.
Yeah. So I was wondering, one of the things I find really impressive about Friends of the Congo is the way that you're shifting the debate around what is happening in the Congo
mm-hmm.
and sort of the information that gets put out there about it
yeah.
in the U.S. because oftentimes, you know, most of our listeners are either on the continent or,
mm-hmm.
you know, African immigrants here, Canada, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
And even on the continent, the information we get about the Congo is so shaped by, you know, the U.S. agenda, if you
mm-hmm.
will, right?
Yeah.
on
yeah.
the continent. And so So I wanted to ask you if you could break down sort of, in simple terms, what do you want people, listeners who are in Africa, to know about what's currently happening in the
mm-hmm.
Congo? And then maybe later we can talk a little bit about what are some things that, you know, people on the continent can do to support.
Sure. Yeah, thanks for that question. The narrative, right,
mm-hmm.
is critical. It's a huge battlefield telling the story, right? So first and foremost, what Friends of Congo does is provide a platform and a space
mm-hmm.
for the story and stories to be told by Congolese,
mm-hmm.
first and foremost.
Yeah.
Now, our spokesperson is Congolese,
mm-hmm.
Kabalima Musavuli.
Mm-hmm.
That's the first thing, making sure that there's a platform. Because when it comes to for Africans telling their stories,
mm-hmm.
whether it's Africans at home or abroad,
mm-hmm.
it's usually a challenge. You
yeah.
know, other folks are usually telling the stories.
That's
so
true.
We've created a space where Africans can tell a story. I think we had the United Nations had published a report in 2010. It's called UN Mapping Exercise Report on the Atrocities that are Committed in the Congo. And we had a briefing in Congress. We organized a briefing in Congress to bring the report to members of Congress. Mm-hmm. And every single person on the panel was African, continental African. Wow. So we're like, this must have been the first time in U.S. Congress that we've had an all-African panel briefing the Congress on what's happening on the African continent, and in this case, in the Great Lakes region. So that's first and foremost, creating that that space. The narrative is so critical that for people to understand that the story of the Congo, the modern history of the Congo, is grounded and based really in the carving up of the African continent as a whole, right? This is a country that wasn't designed by Congolese. It wasn't designed by Africans. Yeah. It was designed by Europeans at the Berlin Conference in 1884, 1885. Mm-hmm. And it was designed with a very specific purpose, and intent. And that is, there are riches there in the country, and those riches were to be extracted to serve Western industries at the expense of the population, right? So that was the original design of the modern state of the Congo. And in that original design, it was a genocidal undertaking. Because within the first 23 years of that country being given at the Berlin Conference to King Leopold II as his own personal property, an estimated 10 to 15 million Congolese lost their lives, right? While the king extracted rubber and ivory, right, to feed the bicycle industry and burgeoning auto industry in the West. Fast forward 130 years or so, 1996, Congo was invaded by its neighbors, Rwanda and Uganda and a few other countries. And from 1996 to 2007 or so, estimated 6 million Congolese lost their lives, right? While coltan and tin
still going
and
on,
all of that were being extracted, right? Resources being extracted, not rubber, but still resources being extracted to serve the technology, the electronics, the aerospace, the military industries in the West and the globe, while Congolese perish, right? So that design hasn't fundamentally changed. And that's part of the reasons for our existence. We're saying that we want to work as hard as we can, as diligently as we can, to make sure that 100 years from today, it's not another mineral that's being extracted from the heart of the African continent at the expense of millions of Africans. So for people to understand what's happening now is that's what's happening. The country's being plundered, right? And in the plundering of the country, the people are being killed. They're perishing, right? If they don't die, they're being raped, like women, as a result of the conflict. Hundreds of thousands of women being systematically raped. And that's why we saw that Dr. Denis Mukwege, just earlier this month, won the Nobel Peace Prize because he's intervened to address the symptoms. You know, the women who are being raped, he's patched up thousands of tens of thousands of women. So it was at least acknowledged by the Nobel Peace Prize Committee for that work. So you have people perishing, women being systematically raped, children of the 6 million that lost their lives, so from 96 to 97, half of them are children under the age of five. Now children are suffering from starvation. I think some 500,000 children face acute starvation in the Congo, according to the United Nations. And people are living in abject poverty, you know, bestial conditions, right? In a country that is arguably, if not the richest, one of the richest countries in the world in terms of natural resources, but with houses some of the poorest people in the world. So that extractive process, that exploitation continues. What's different today, there are a few things that are different. One is you have these comprador elites. These are elites basically that serve the interests of foreign finance capital, multinational corporations, who are presiding over the looting of the Congo, a small clique that's backed up by foreign governments, then they benefit personally, and their job is basically to keep the population in check, you know, to use the military to suppress the population, a population that's demanding the basics, right? Education, clean water, jobs, right? Healthcare, electricity, just basic stuff that we experience here and it's normal for us, right? For people living in the Congo, it's you wake up in the morning and the primary concern for the overwhelming majority of people is what am I going to eat today? How do I survive?
Yeah.
Right? In a land of plenty. So that's those are the structural impediments that the Congolese people face. And in one of one of the roles that we play is in telling that story, providing a platform for that story to be told by Congolese themselves. So where we have things today in the country is not dissimilar from a number of other countries. We have a leader that was initially imposed on the Congolese people. His name is Joseph Kabila. He's been in the leadership since 2001. He quote-unquote won elections in 2006 and again in 2011. And according to Congo's constitution, you're only allowed to serve 2 5-year terms. His second 5-year term ended in December of 2016, but he decided he wanted to stay, right? So he's been in power 2 years beyond his constitutional mandate, and as a result of tremendous sacrifice from the Congolese people, losing a number of the youth in resisting this attempt by Kabila to perpetuate his stay in power, finally, in August of this year, said that he was going to step aside and give another person a chance. He chose a successor. However, he's still very much in control. Of course, even his successor that he has chosen is still part of that. Before even choosing the successor, he established a coalition where he was the head of that coalition. And that coalition and Kabila himself controls the security forces, controls the purse strings, controls an electoral process where elections are supposed to be held this December. So even in finally organizing elections, they're organizing elections with a certainty to maintain the status quo, right? In terms of stacking the deck, rigging the playing field. So right now, the battle that's unfolding in the country is the youth, civil society, some in the opposition to prevent the rigging of the elections. Because if a somewhat free, not totally free, somewhat free elections were held, the people are not stupid. You know, they've been kept in in terrible conditions for 17 years. They're not going to vote for you to continue that, right? So fully being aware of this, Kabila and them know they cannot expose themselves to the will of the people. So they're trying to set up a system where the elections will be a foregone conclusion. They're supposed to be held on December 23rd of this year. And Kabila's successor and the Kabila majority coalition would remain in power for the next 5 years.
Do they have like a good position, you know, leader or, you know, like people who could, like...
Yeah, that's part of the problem, right? The opposition is compromised.
Mm-hmm.
There's a problem not just with the majority coalition, but there's a problem with the political class. The political class suffers from opportunism. Their primary concern is them first, their stomachs, and feeding themselves figuratively. And that's part of the reason why the youth are organizing in the fashion that they are. They want to overturn the system, not just get rid of a leader, but really upend a political class that's prioritized their personal interests over the larger interests of the population at large. And another insidious element of the so-called opposition too is that they are quick and ready to be of service to foreign interests.
Yeah.
Right? And so there is no shortage of opposition figures in line that are ready to come to the doors of the State Department in the United States, for example, or the Champs-Élysées in France, you know, or in Belgium. So that the youth are fighting that battle to really not against, not only against, not against an individual, but against a system, but also a battle to, an affirmative battle to create a new system, to create a new society, a new culture, where the general will, general welfare is the priority and not the personal interests of particular politicians or certain elite that have benefited from the way that things have run in the past.
It's like many battles, you know, like,
yes,
you know, you kind of got, you have to go step by step. And this, you know, the other side is on full speed mode, but you have to do all these little steps.
And it's a generational battle.
Yeah,
well.
And it's it's throughout Africa.
Throughout
Not
Africa.
Just Africa, but throughout, you know, like a lot of nations.
And that's why we say that Congo is emblematic of the continent as a whole. It's just that what happens, it's such a big country. Everything's so big, so it happens in extreme, right? So when it comes to the tragedies that we see on the continent, Congo is emblematic of that. You know, there's no, really, if you look at the country, there's no other country in the world since the European slave trade that has suffered to the extent that Congo has in terms of loss of life, right? It just doesn't exist.
Yeah.
So the extreme tragedies are there, but then again, you also have the potential. Tremendous potential, not only in terms of its natural resources, but in terms of its human resources. Mm-hmm. 80 million people with a median age of 17, right? So that just represents tremendous potential if given the space or the climate for all of that human potential to be married with the natural potential that exists in the country. It could be revolutionary for the African continent, you know?
Yeah, and I feel like Congo, as you said, Congo itself could, like, help the whole world, not just Africa, but the whole world.
Yes.
And if you think about it, you know, when they, when I was reading this thing with Kabila, the father, when he kicked off this, the guy from Rwanda. I think his name is Kabarere.
When he kicked
the guy out.
Yes.
And, you know, Rwanda and this ally attacked Congo. The country, like, what helps Kabila at that time was Angola, Angola's military. You know, they were able to push back the Rwandan army. I mean, not just Rwanda, Uganda, and even Mozambique, and probably back up with the West, but they were able to push them back out of Kinshasa, right? But it had to be, they had to get help from outside. Yeah. Mm-hmm. You know, and I guess Angola realized, you know, if this country is being seized, it's going to affect them. So, you know, they probably joined forces to head to Congo then. Even though now, you know, in the news, like someone, like they're kicking some Congolese out of Angola.
Yeah.
You know, like, I feel like without that unity among us Africans, it's going to be hard because, you know, you're doing a great job here, but on the, like, even on the continent.
Yeah.
I have a lot of friends, I mean, not friends, but people, especially from, like, West Africa. Mm-hmm. They look at the Rwandan president, what's his name again? Kagame, as, you know, someone who is doing a good job. And I have to debate all the time with them that,
right.
You know,
right.
This guy is, I mean, we had the same. We had a president like Kagame,
mm-hmm.
You know, like, I don't know if you follow the history of Burkina Faso.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, you see Compaoré.
Compaoré, yes.
And Kagame, they're like from the same mother.
Same cloth.
You know, cut from the same cloth. Like, even to the way they operate, mm-hmm. You know, Burkina had someone who was in the army doing the dirty job, just like Cabarere was doing, mm-hmm. He's doing in, you know, Rwanda. Kagame. So I feel like, you know, it has to be a connection.
Yes, yes.
Among us Africans.
And I have to say, it's happening. You know, it is happening. We were just, Friends of the Congo was just in Ghana,
mm-hmm.
Participating in a Pan-African conference where we had some 60 countries from around the world, mm-hmm. participate, over 500 delegates. And there were a dozen Congolese there.
Mm-hmm.
And what was fascinating and rewarding about the conference,
mm-hmm.
is that you had these young Congolese sitting down with these young Burkinabes.
Mm-hmm.
And they were having discussions, and Burkinabes were sharing with them, you know, what they did to be successful,
mm-hmm.
where they fell short, mm-hmm. in their ousting of Kambare,
mm-hmm.
and how Congolese can use some of those tactics in the Congo.
Yeah.
And then they were also talking with the Haitians who were there. So that solidarity, that support,
mm-hmm.
it's happening. There's a group, several formations on the continent that are developing. Before that, some of the Congolese were in Tanzania talking with other Africans about Congo, Togo, Gambia. You know, so these conferences, these gatherings, as Rodney would probably call them, these groundings, you know, are unfolding on the continent, and I'm very optimistic about that. And to give you an example and tie in Kagame as well,
mm-hmm.
If you followed what unfolded this late summer in Uganda, for example,
mm-hmm.
Museveni,
mm-hmm.
In his jailing and torturing of Bobby Wine, when he did that, some of the most vocal voices in support of Bobby Wine were the Kenyans, right? And Kenyans were organizing demonstrations, and some Rwandans from outside of Rwanda, right? Congolese were supporting Bobby Wine, chastising Museveni,
mm-hmm.
and as we saw the support build around Bobby Wine and the repressive tactics that were being utilized by Museveni,
mm-hmm.
then the discussion arced into Rwanda, mm-hmm. right? So Bobby Wine was then compared to Diane Rigara, who was jailed by Kagame because she ran for president, mm-hmm. in the last elections. And it also morphed into discussions, you know, around Victor Ingabire, right? Who ran for elections, I think it was 2010,
mm-hmm.
that was jailed by Kagame. So here's a guy, these West Africans who are celebrating Kagame, as you talked,
mm-hmm.
about, here's a guy who's won his elections, three elections, I believe it is, and I think the lowest percentage that he had was 93%. Now, in my own family, I don't have 93% agreement. Were you getting 93%, 95%? The last elections, he won with 99%.
Yeah.
You know, that. So ask the Ghanaians, ask the Burkinabes, if that's what they want, somebody who's winning 99% of the vote. And in order for you to win 99% of the vote in any country, you basically have to destroy the opposition, right?
Yeah.
You have to jail them, you have to kill them,
mm-hmm.
right? and you have to terrorize the population. That's how you win 99%. So that's how Kagame moves. And for all his bluster about independence and we as Africans ought to do things ourselves, that's fine in terms of rhetoric. But if you look at Thomas Sankara, that's what he said, and that's what he did with his people. Kagame, almost half of his budget comes from the West. If you look at how he moves, right, he's aligned with some of the most, he's aligned with the 1%. He's aligned with Tony Blair. He's aligned with Bill Clinton. He's aligned with Sheldon Adelson. Sheldon Adelson is a Jewish billionaire in the United States that supports Donald Trump, that supports Newt Gingrich. These are the folks that he's aligned with. When you see him engaged, he's at the World Economic Forum in Davos, right? He's not at the World Social Forum somewhere else in the Global South. So these folks who are holding up Kagame as a model, they really need to take a deeper look into what how he's arrived where he is with a full backing of the West, you know, military support from the United States, training from the United States, intelligence, equipment, financing, the whole bit. So, and he's fully ensconced in a neo-colonial or neoliberal undertaking. He's really one of the preeminent agents of neocolonialism on the African continent. So he doesn't represent the future of Africa. In fact, he represents a dying breed. Once these young people in Kenya, the Bobby Wines, and in Uganda, these young people are the ones who represent the future of the African continent. Yeah. Kagame's got so much blood on his hands that for people to hold him up as a model means that they've become victims and susceptible to the propaganda campaign that he runs and that is backed by his Western advised marketing consultants.
Do you mind talking a little bit about the role that Rwanda and Uganda have played in perpetuating the atrocities in the Congo, just for people who don't know the context?
Sure. From the 96 to 2007 time frame that I shared with you, during that time where an estimated 6 million people lost their lives as a result of really a war of aggression. In 96, Rwanda and Uganda invaded the Congo, where they said they were going after those who committed the genocide in Rwanda. And they were, but that wasn't the only design, as you pointed out. When they went after those folks in the Congo who participated in the genocide, they went all the way and they overthrew Mobutu, right, May of 1997. So if they were... That was their intention, just to go after those who participated in the genocide. Then they would have left Congo to the Congolese, right? But as you rightly stated, what they did was installed their own leadership in the Congo. James Kabarebe was the chief of the military in the Congo when the Rwandans and Ugandans installed Laurent Kabila, because Kabila didn't have a military of his own. So Kabila was got to a point where he's trying to shake himself loose of the Rwandans and Ugandans, and that's when he sent the Rwandans packing in August of 1998. And so why did he do that? And the response was swift. Rwanda and Uganda invaded again in 1998. Fortunately for Kabila, he had joined the Southern African Development Community. So he then reached out to Namibia and Zimbabwe and Angola to come to his support, because he had no military still. So that's when those countries came and pushed back the Rwandan and Ugandan second invasion, that 98 war, which the International Rescue Committee said that It resulted in the loss of 5.4 million lives, that 1998 war, which had some 11 African countries or so involved in the conflict. This time, Angola was on the side of the Congolese. And it was in the 96 war, Angola was on the side of Rwanda and Uganda, because Angola had strategic interests.
Yeah.
You know, Jonas Savimbi was in Angola, Mobutu was in power in Zaire, mm-hmm. then was a CIA conduit to UNITA and Savimbi, and in terms of money, equipment, the whole bit. So Angola wanted to cut that umbilical cord. So once they cut it and got rid of Mobutu, they were like, okay, let's leave Congo pretty much to the Congolese. But then the Rwandans and Ugandans said, no, we want the gold, we want the timber, we want the coltan. You know, we want to control the Congo remotely and benefit from its riches. So that's what produced the current situation when the SADC nations, Southern African Development Community nations, drove back Rwanda and Uganda. They came to a peace accord in 2002, and then there was a transition in the Congo from 2003 to 2006. But Rwanda and Uganda kept supporting militia groups. They had proxies. They couldn't. They weren't openly in the Congo with their military. Mm-hmm. Now they were clandestinely in the Congo. They set up different militia groups in the Congo and provided them with training, financing, sent their top military officials in with them in certain instances to continue to destabilize the Congo. And that continues to this day. That continues to this day that the east of the country, of the Congo, is the most unstable part of that country. And a major part of the reason for that is because of Congo's neighbors, Rwanda and Uganda.
With all these, reports and, proofs and all these, why are they still being supported by the U.S. and, all their allies, especially the U.S.?
The U.S., Europe, United Kingdom, these are nations and formations that act on their interests.
Yeah.
They don't act on morality or justice or any of those things that we hold dear. They act on interest. And if it's in their interest to have Kagame and Museveni remain in power in Uganda and Rwanda and basically control the region or have strong influence over the region, they can do that. You know, it was in their interest to Congolese in 1960. Democratically elected Patrice Emery Lumumba and his Mouvement National Congolais, his party. And within weeks, the United States overthrew him, right? And which led to his assassination. Within weeks of Lumumba being inaugurated. And not only did they overthrow Lumumba, right? But they installed Mobutu, right?
Yeah.
The dictator, for over three decades. Right? Installed Mobutu for over three decades. And when they were ready to get rid of Mobutu, they got rid of him. They backed the invasion of the Congo by Rwanda and Uganda. So they act in their interest. And if it's in their interest to have Mobutu in power for three decades, they have him in there. And if in their interest to get rid of him and have Rwanda and Uganda basically be the proxies that control what's happening in Central Africa, the heart of the continent, then they do that. So it's for us to cut through that narrative that they try to sell to people that they're supporting Africa and supporting them. I don't know of a freedom liberation movement on the African continent that was supported by the West. I think the marker for us, for people of African ancestry, for Africans on the continent, to really understand what the standard is for them, right? Everybody supports Nelson Mandela, right, as a hero of the African continent, right? A freedom fighter, right? Fighting for justice and peace, right? Do you know that that man was on the U.S. terrorist list until 2008? For the United States, Nelson Mandela was a terrorist. And even to this day, members of the ANC is on the terrorist list for the United States. So if that's the marker, for people to understand where their interests are, right? If you're going to put somebody like Mandela on the terrorist list, then it clearly demonstrates that you're not interested in peace for Africans. Yeah. You're not interested in freedom for Africans. You're not interested in liberation for Africans. You're not interested in principles of justice, right? And the principles of self-determination, right? That's the litmus test. It should be anyways for Africans when it comes to judging where the U.S. and Western powers are when it comes to the freedom and liberation for Africans.
I think it's actually a really good segue into talking a little bit about what can Africans on the continent or living in a diaspora do to support, a better future for the Congo and for the continent as a whole. And I guess I'm thinking about it at different scales, like both in terms of how do we support the organizing that is happening on the ground, but also how do we build the kind of infrastructures and institutions, perhaps, not build them, but how do we hold those institutions like the African Union accountable, in a way that isn't sort of filtered through the interests of the U.S. and Europe?
I think there's several things. I think, one, the amplifying of the stories coming out of the Congo is really important. And the telling of critical stories, because when it comes to the Congo, people tend to get despondent and discouraged. They're exposed to the pornography of violence. And violence does occur, but that's not the whole story. So looking at Congo in a holistic fashion, and broadening the lens, I think is really important. Telling the right story, sharing the narrative, amplifying the stories coming out of the Congo, like what we're doing today, right? Today you have me doing a podcast. Tomorrow could be some of the young people on the ground who are fighting for change in the country. So using the whatever platforms that you have in order to get the word out about the resiliency, about the resistance, about the pursuit that these young people are, and people across the board inside the country have to achieve some level of peace, to achieve some level of justice, and really this pursuit for human dignity. So telling that story is really critical, and leveraging all the platforms at our disposal to do so is important, whether they're podcasts, radio outlets, newspapers, blogs, television, you just name it. So telling that story is really important. That's one thing. Connecting with the youth on the ground, who are the forefront of social justice movement, and being in solidarity with them. There's a website that they can visit for English speakers. It's Telema, TELEMA.org. They can go on that site. Immediately you can sign up. There's even a solidarity statement on there that they can support. But that's one immediate way to be in communication with the youth on the ground. There's another website, Captiam Voix. CaptiamVoix.org is a youth organization that's doing incredible work. They can connect with them there as well. And it's being in solidarity with them means being there for them when things ostensibly go down. Just this morning, one of the youth leaders in the east of the country was being pursued by the governor and had to go into hiding. The leader of Captain Bois' name is Jean-Marie Colongi. He's been arrested 4 times. He was the last time he was put in a military detention camp and tortured. And what happened was there was an outpouring of support from the young Africans, from Nigerians, folks from Cote d'Ivoire, from Burkina Faso. They were making videos and sharing it. When he was in the military detention camp, the guards were asking, like, who are you? Why are so many people making noise about you? Right? So that making that noise is really important for people living in under repressive regime. So leveraging that technology, shoot a video, sharing that video about young people who are being persecuted. There's one young man, his name is Christian Lumu. He's a part of one of the opposition parties, the Union for Democracy and Social Progress, mm-hmm. in the Congo. And he's been in jail for almost a year now. He was just picked up, no reason, no explanation. He's been in jail, and we're fighting to get him out of jail. So Christian Lumu is someone that should be on the lips of every African that's listening to this and broadcast. And if they go to Telema, TELEMA.org, mm-hmm. they can find out. There's a link there that says take action. Mm-hmm. They can take action to send emails, to send tweets to the Ministry of Human Rights in the Congo, Minister of Interior, and let them know that we want Christian released, that he shouldn't be in jail. There's no reason for holding him. So those are some initial steps that people can take. We're organizing delegations to the Congo. So if you want to be a part of a delegation that's going to go in the Congo, sit with the youth, sit with human rights defenders, sit with activists, and help to amplify their story, you know, just let us know. You can visit us at friendsofthecongo.org and just go to our contact us page and let us know that you want to be a part of one of the delegations that you're leading to the Congo to be a part of this movement for peace and justice in the Congo.
I think we're getting into his time. I just wanted him to just talk a little bit about what he's doing tonight about the U.S. militarization.
Yes, tonight I'm here in New York. I'm based in D.C. here for a forum that's focusing on U.S. militarization around the world. And I'll be speaking about U.S. militarization on the African continent. As some of your viewing and listening audience may know, that U.S. has different command structures throughout the world. And in 2008, 10 years ago, October 2008, they established an African command, which they call AFRICOM. Initially, they wanted to establish a base on the continent, but it was rejected by almost all the African heads of state. Except for Ellen Johnson Sirleaf, she was of Liberia. She's like, come on in, put a base in here. But since that time, especially under the Obama administration, the U.S. military footprint on the African continent has increased almost 2,000%, right? They have a presence in a host of African countries, some 40 African countries. They, of course, they're in Djibouti, the military base there. The Chinese just came with a military base there, so there are different global players. That's a very critical, sensitive area of the continent. But they also, the U.S. is also building drone bases around the continent. In Niger, they have a $100 million drone base they're building. They just established a presence there. They call them lily pads in Ghana. And they face fierce resistance from the Ghanaians, but they prevail nonetheless. So they said they're establishing these military presence to pursue terrorists. But the greatest act, I believe, on the African continent that resulted in a proliferation of terrorist groups was when the United States conducted a regime change in removing Gaddafi. In Libya, what it did was it unleashed, opened up a Pandora's box where weapons and were flowed into the Sahel. There's a G5. It's made up of five nations. I think Burkina Faso is a part of it. They come to Washington often, and when they come, they're telling the U.S. Listen, I think they're coming. They're requesting like $600 million from the U.S. to fight terrorism in the Sahel. And they're saying, listen, you're responsible. You overthrew Gaddafi, and that caused, proliferation of weapons and terrorist groups. So you need to put some money on the table. So you have these African leaders who want the U.S. to come and bring the money for their own purposes, not just as necessary to fight terrorism. They usually use U.S. Largesse to suppress their people, as we see Paul Biya doing in the Cameroon, right? Mm-hmm. He's getting U.S. There's some 300 U.S. Soldiers there training the Cameroonian military. And we've seen on the videos where that's been verified, the Cameroon military executing a mother and a child, walking them out into the bush, telling them to kneel down, and then just shooting them in the back of the head, you know, mother and child. So these are U.S.-trained soldiers, right? So one of the things that these African governments do is when they get the equipment, they get the training, they get the financing, and they get the political and diplomatic cover, then that gives them free rein to suppress their population, which they do, whether we're talking about Rwanda, Uganda, Cameroon, you know, you name it. So we're talking about all of that tonight in a way that it's a part of the public or political education effort that we have here in the U.S. to let people know what's going on in the continent and the role that the U.S. is playing and what they're doing, the United States is doing, in the name of U.S. taxpayers.
Mm. Yeah, that's you know, my problem with it too, because it's like almost we pay the taxes and we don't care. We even purchase a lot of stuff and we don't even think about where our money is going. Because a lot of corporations, you know, backing up, you know, the Kagames and, you know, those criminals back home, they have money because of us. Like, we put money in their pockets.
Absolutely.
So it's like, it's really good that, you know, like, all these amazing things that your organization is doing, you know, it's important for the population, like the individuals to understand that, you know, we have the power too. Like, if we decide we're not going to deal with or even give our money to a company, even if you backing up, you know, whoever, even here, like, you know, if you going to Walmart, just as an example, if you're going to Walmart to buy your stuff and you know that Walmart is backing up a racist, that is creating laws that is killing your own people, why would you be going to Walmart?
Well,
you're
just mistreating their workers.
Yeah, because what people need to realize is the same people who are killing the Congo, it's the same people who are killing America.
Oh,
so it's like, you know.
Absolutely.
I know we're running out of time, but I wanted to ask one last question because I feel like as an African woman, we get images coming out of the Congo that, as you said, are really, they're you know, they make me feel paralyzed often. Mm-hmm. And I see women, you know, because of gender-based violence, I don't see enough of women affected by gender-based violence on these platforms speaking about their organizing, about their leadership. You know, we see them sort of as victims, but they're survivors and they're organizers as well.
Right.
And so I wondered if, and this is kind of a twofold question, if you could tell us about the role that women are playing in organizing, whether it's in the Congo or the conference that you mentioned earlier. And then sort of we could end maybe on what makes you hopeful. Tell us one thing that you feel like gives you hope at the moment.
Yeah.
And it can be a very specific thing, but just so that we kind of end on that.
Yeah. Women are very much engaged in leadership at different areas of the society. We talked about Dr. Mukwege. He's working with women in the City of Joy. It's a city that was created with Dr. Mukwege. Christine described her. She's a Congolese. And Eve Ensler, who's here in the U.S., Jeanne Monologues. They're creating leadership cadres there. It's a young lady in the east of the Congo. Brave young lady. Her name is Justine Masika. She's organized at the grassroots level. Advocating on behalf of women who have been victims of sexual violence, and at the risk of her own life, she's been threatened and had to either go into hiding, seek protection. We see women at the forefront, especially when it comes to questions around sexual violence. I mentioned to you the Cathy Mvua, one of the organizations we work with. Their spokesperson is a young lady. Her name is Elsie. She spokesperson for the organization. Mm-hmm. When Jean-Marie was in jail, she stood up and took over the reins of the organization and put the men in check who were trying to take advantage of the of the moment, and she held the boat steady. So we see that whether it's in social justice, questions of sexual violence, women being a part of on the forefront of fight for peace, fight for justice. There needs to be more, because half the population are women, and that's one of the things that I'm hopeful about, right? Among the youth, they're conscious of this, and making sure that they create a space for women, mm-hmm. right? When we went to Ghana, the delegation for the Pan-African Movement, I don't remember how many women there were, but almost half of the delegation were women, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. So when it's time for them to travel outside of the country and engage other Africans, they're sending women. It's like they for each male they send, they try to send a female as well, right? So that I'm very hopeful about that mm-hmm. gender balance in the movement among the youth. Mm-hmm. Also, how can I say? I think that even though it may not seem like it at times, I think the future of the African continent is in good hands. I feel like we are in at the early stages of a revolution taking place on the continent. The continent is mostly teenagers, mm-hmm. right? And it's like we have the independence movement that overthrew colonialism, mm-hmm. right? And then the force returned with neocolonialism, right? Yeah. As Kwame Nkrumah describes in his Class Struggle in Africa. And impose these leaders, tyrannical leaders, to basically maintain the status quo, right? Mm-hmm. Where colonialists, the old colonialists, benefited, mm-hmm. right? By installing agents of neocolonialism. Blaise Compaoré, mm-hmm. just study the Burkina Faso example. That's a classic example of neocolonialism and how it works, right? So now, these tyrannical leaders that have been put over the population are being challenged, right? They're challenged in Senegal. Mm-hmm. They're challenged most dramatically in Burkina Faso. So I think we're going to see more of that on the continent. There's some hopes, with Prime Minister Abe in Ethiopia. Mm-hmm. You're talking about women, even his saying that we want half of the cabinet to be women, appointing a woman president. So I think that's going to be, I believe that's going to be the new norm. We see Bobi Wine in Uganda, another young person, mm-hmm. Even though he's an individual, mm-hmm. represent the voices of thousands, tens of thousands, maybe hundreds of thousands of young people. Right, so not just looking in the Congo, but looking throughout the continent, we see Africans rising. It's a new Pan-African formation mm-hmm. that's made up of young people who are organizing throughout the continent in solidarity with particular countries as they go through crisis, whether it's in the Cameroon or Togo or Gambia or the Congo. Just a lot of activity. Just that it hasn't reached a critical mass yet, mm-hmm. but I think once that critical mass of youth social justice activists mm-hmm. who want to overturn the tyrannical system that's been imposed on them, once that critical mass is reached, I think there's no stopping the continent.
Yeah.
Great. Thank you so much for this conversation. It's really eye-opening.
Thank you.
I was going to ask you, Patrice Lumumba is like every African should just use him as, not a standard, but what he did.
Mm-hmm.
I was talking to a big brother of mine, Coney, and he was saying, Lumumba was able to escape the people who were like running after him to kill him.
Mm-hmm.
But they had his family, so he was on the other side of the river already.
Mm-hmm.
He came back because of his family, just to show how important Africa should be for us.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Malcolm X said he was the greatest African to ever walk the continent. The reason why he said that is because he said Lumumba couldn't be reached, he couldn't be bought off.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
He belonged to the people. Yeah. There was no way to reach him.
Mm-hmm.
And that's an excellent model for future generations to follow, to belong to the people.
Yeah.
That you serve the interests and the will of the people.
Mm.
So for Africans on the continent, he's certainly a model. And young people are in the Congo, they're embracing him. They're embracing his teachings.
Mm-hmm.
They're embracing his ideas. Although the Belgians cut him up into small pieces and put his body into his cut up pieces of body into acid to disintegrate and wipe them out.
That's
fertilizer.
Yeah.
And now we have thousands of
Lumumbas
sprouting. And for people outside, he made an appeal to them in his last letter to his wife. He said to the Congo, we're not alone.
Mm-hmm.
Africa, Asia, free and liberated people
mm-hmm.
will always be found on the side of the Congolese.
Yeah.
So that's the appeal that we're making for the Burkina Bay, those who the Cote d'Ivoire, Ghana, Tanzania, Mozambique, Uganda, Sudan, Egypt, to be found at the side of the Congo.
Thank you so much. Well, I know we got into your time, but we really appreciate you having the time.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, absolutely.